All right, thanks very much. I will be talking about classification errors in regression models, and I'm taking a Bayesian semi-parametric approach. My talk will perhaps be a little bit more sort of model and methods based than the others, so I hope you'll bear with me. Now this is, start with the disclosure, so I have no relationships to disclose for this work. I'm going to give you a brief introduction and then talk about the model that I have in mind. I'll outline it and tell you a little bit about the Bayesian semi-parametric estimation method and the reasons why I think that's sort of a viable or an interesting alternative in models with classification errors. I have a small application to the NISDA, which is the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, but I'm certainly willing to think about sort of other applications or data sets. So if you have any thoughts on that, I'd definitely appreciate to hear about it. Okay, classification errors. So classification errors are essentially is a form of measurement error in categorical variables, and they are a frequent concern. So there's actually quite a large literature that has looked at this type of errors. And the first set of papers by Bollinger and David and Meyer, they come from the economics literature, and they look at factors that can actually predict the degree of measurement error. There are also some papers about the effect of the survey instrument, so how do you pose certain questions, how do you phrase your instrument, and also what's the environment in which these questions are asked, and then trying to figure out how that might affect the quality of responses. And then finally, I've identified a strand of literature that looks at, you know, trying to make adjustments in estimation. So, for example, if we're trying to estimate the prevalence of a disease or the prevalence of a behavior in the population, how do we estimate or adjust the means or the probabilities? So, what is my contribution here to this field? At least the contribution I hope to make. I'm running ahead a little bit. I'm not getting there yet. So. What I'm going to do is look at a regression model, and if you think about the misclassified covariate and the coefficient, that's the object that we're trying to estimate, then that coefficient is not identified unless we impose further structure or impose further information into the model. Now, if we use only weak assumptions, it can be shown that the coefficient is partially identified, and partial identification is a concept that has become wildly popular in economics and econometrics, starting in the 90s, and I'm not sure, you know, to what extent this has made its way into other fields, but the idea is very simple. So the coefficient cannot be estimated exactly, it's not point identified, but you can derive bounds on the coefficient, and those bounds can be consistently estimated. So I've listed a number of references there. And the issue with this is that inference is actually fairly complicated. So if you're trying to conduct proper statistical inference with the right properties, tests with the correct size, you're needing to make inference about a set, and that's a random set, so it's not an estimator. So this is fairly complicated, and I don't think it has made its way yet into a lot of applied practice. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to propose a Bayesian method of inference. And I have several new things that I do here. So first of all, I look at continuous outcomes, or they can be continuous, they can be categorical, unlike some earlier work that has looked at just a binary outcome. And the second innovation is that I'm actually using a semi-parametric model. So I'm not going to put too much structure on the model. I'm not going to, say, impose a normal distribution or a t-distribution. I'm going to keep it fairly weak and see, you know, how much progress I can make under those circumstances. So I would say that that's one of the advantages. There's no need to impose a parametric assumption. And when we think about the inferences that come out of this, we can actually use prior distributions in a Bayesian setup to get to inferences that can be pretty sharp or relatively sharp compared to the bounding analysis that that you would do in a non-Bayesian setup. Okay, so let me briefly talk about the model. I'll just walk you through a couple slides. I have a very simple outcome equation in mind. Here, Z is a binary covariate It has some probability pi of being equal to 1. And u is just a regression error. Now, I could have put other covariates in there too. So let's say another set of x's or w's. And then you know, I could go through the motions as well, but it would complicate the notation. So for that reason, I'm just focusing on a regression model with a single covariate. But it can be generalized. The classification issue is written down in the equation at the bottom. So we do not observe z, but we observe, let's say, an x, which is also binary, but it may not be equal to z. So there are some quantities in there, a p and a q. So let's say, for example, that z is equal to 0. That equation says that, well, x can be equal to 1 with probability p. Right? So a simple way to look at that equation is to say that p is the probability of a false positive, and q would be the probability of a false negative. Okay. What can I do with this model? Well, I can do some algebraic manipulations, and I can think about the means and variances of x and y. So keep in mind, x and y is our data, right? And means and variances and covariances in the data, I can certainly estimate, right, without a problem. So the things on the left-hand side are not an issue. Those are identified. However, I'm more interested in the parameters on the right-hand side. So in particular, the alphas and the betas, right, the regression parameters, and then the p and the q are the measurement error probabilities. But in this simple setup, you see there are 4 equations and 6 unknowns. Right? This is not, you cannot solve this. Right? So that's one way to understand that the parameters are not identified if we just look at means and covariances. So what can we do instead? Right? It seems like a pretty hopeless situation here, but we can actually make a little bit of progress. So let me make 2 assumptions. And the first assumption is that p and q sum to something that's less than 1. And it can be shown that that simply means that there's a positive covariance between z and x. So in other words, I'm allowing for classification error, but it's not so bad that it's going to flip the order. Right? So it's not so bad that I'm going to make the covariance between z and x negative. The second assumption is that the covariance between x and y is positive. And now that in itself is not restrictive, because I can, suppose I had a negative covariance, I can just recode x as 1 minus x, right, and make it positive. So that's, in a way, it's not really an assumption, or it's not restrictive. Under that assumption, it can be shown that that the beta coefficient, right, it's actually bounded, has a lower and an upper bound. And if you look at that display, you might recognize the lower bound as your standard OLS coefficient, right? At least that's where your OLS coefficient converges to in probability. And then the upper bound is a combination of terms. And one of my papers that this presentation is based on, I actually look at, you know, how do these bounds change when we impose different types of information? Right? So I'm not going to spell out all the cases here, but when you have a little bit of information about the misclassification, you can stick it in, and it actually tightens the bounds, which is what you would expect. So, for example, I've listed 2 cases here. If you know that there are no false negatives, right, or if you know that there are no false positives, right, this may be a reasonable assumption in some settings. Then you still have a bounded set. You still have a lower and an upper bound, but it can be shown that these bounds are tighter. Right? So that's the value of the information. Okay. Now let me move on to estimation. So I've laid out the problem, the identification problem. How would we go about estimating this model? And I've listed here a few classifications just to make the notation a little bit simpler. Theta here are the parameters that I'm really interested in. Those are the regression parameters. The nuisance parameters, I call them nuisance because I kind of, you know, I know that they're there, but that's not really what I'm after. So those are the error probabilities. And then phi, finally, are the moments of my data. Right? Again, phi is not a problem. So in a Bayesian model, I don't know how many Bayesians there are here in this audience, but the object of Bayesian inference is always going to be a posterior distribution. That's what you use to make inference. That's what you use to construct a quote-unquote confidence interval. And it follows simply from Bayes' rule. So the display there is just Bayes' rule. And The second line there is the way it's usually written in Bayesian papers or in textbooks, which says that the posterior distribution is proportional to the product of two things. Right, the first term, fxy, is just the distribution of the data, the likelihood function. Frequentists use that as well. And then f theta p and q is the prior distribution. Now, I need to put several elements into this model. Right, just going back to the idea of partial identification, the bounds. If I write down the likelihood, I know that these parameters are not all identified. Right, so what I want, the Bayesian model that I propose uses a likelihood that only depends on the things that I can identify. Right, so that's the first line. So phi is something that I can estimate. And in this model, I'm not going to impose, say, normality or a parametric form. I'm actually going to consider the class of distributions that satisfies a simple set of conditions. Right, so for example, what does the mean satisfy? Well, the mean of x minus mu is equal to 0. Right, so those are simple identities. And that's all the structure that I'm going to impose on the likelihood. So the way that this likelihood is used in the inferential procedure is a little bit non-standard, and in fact you have to use some simulation methods. So I've listed there two references that are relevant, Chamberlain and Imbens and Shenick. There are other ways to do this too, but it's a semi-parametric likelihood. Now, let's go back to the parameter of interest, right? So I've laid out the likelihood. What if I want to learn about the regression parameter? What do I do? Well, we look at the posterior. So let me walk you through a few steps here. The posterior, for example, of beta and phi. Well, the first line there is simply Bayes' rule, right? Likelihood times prior. However, the second line uses, again, the fact that beta itself is not identified. So in other words, I want the likelihood in which it doesn't show up. Right? So that's the second line. Beta sort of disappears out of the likelihood. And then if you stare at that second line, you see likelihood as a function of phi times the prior of phi. So that's just simply the posterior. So that leads us to the last line. Right? The posterior of phi times a conditional prior. And that's really important in any Bayesian analysis of a model in which you have these identification problems. So the data are informative about phi. Right? Again, the mean, the variance, the covariance, not a problem. However, what if we look at the unidentified parameter? Well, we still learn about the parameter, but if you look at the last line in the display there, the learning happens through the conditional prior. Right? And that's really important. We learn about beta because we learn about phi. And that is a feature of any type of non-identified or partially identified model. Right? And that's also something that that will happen here. Okay. So let me sort of step back from all those equations and give you a little bit of an application. And again, this is something that I put together fairly quickly. So I'd certainly welcome sort of more serious thoughts on, or maybe you're working on something in which classification is an issue. So I'd certainly like to think about that. I'm looking at a public file of the NISDA, 2009, and I'm just looking at the relation between drug use or abstinence and income. And so I've just given you a few summary stats of what you can find in that data. It looks at a range of substances, cocaine, crack, hallucinogens, painkillers, and stimulants. And then there are several questions about use. Did you use over your lifetime? Did you use during the past year or the past month? And and you see the different response rates there in that 2009 NISDA. Now, for my application here, I'm going to just look at painkillers. And keep in mind, this is the way that NISDA asked this. This is about non-medical use of painkillers. So the question, I think, is, have you used painkillers that were not prescribed and that you took for the experience or to feel high, something like that. Right? So non-prescription medicine use. The Z here in the second line is actually abstinence. So I'm just flipping this around. Right? The NISDA reports use. I'm just doing one minus, so that's abstinence. And I'm assuming that there is some degree of underreporting. Right? So there may be some people who say, oh, I didn't use this, but they actually did. And I think it's fairly reasonable that there's no overreporting. So if I didn't use painkillers, I'm not going to say that I did. Right? So that's my assumption here. Now, if you look at the non-parametric bounds, I've written them here in an equation, and I had them on an earlier slide as well. You see that they're fairly wide. So, for example, the PU hat, that's the upper bound on the underreporting probability. So this, if you do a purely non-parametric analysis, you would say that the underreporting probability is between 0 and 92%. Right? That's a huge, huge interval. What about the difference in income between those abstinent and those using? That's the beta. Well, if you just estimate the lower and the upper bound, you get a difference, and this is in thousands, that's between $6,600 and $292,000. Right? Again, these bounds are huge, so I would argue that for inference, you know, these are not very practical. And you can report them, but you know they're not going to tell you much. So I would argue that this is exactly where you'd like to, you know, use a little bit more information, perhaps intuition, perhaps information from prior studies or what you know about misreporting, to actually input that into the model. And that could happen through the prior. So I'm just going to consider a few priors, and you can probably come up with a bunch of other ones that you think are reasonable. But the first one says that my misclassification probability could be anywhere, right? Uniform. So that's a fairly, you know, a lot of people might not like that one. The second one is maybe a bit more reasonable. So it says that with a pretty high probability, I think there's some underreporting. With 90% probability, I think it's between 0 and 10%. Maybe it's higher, but I'm going to just put a small probability on that. So that's that F2. Right, that's kind of a mixture of two types of beliefs. And then finally, there's a prior that says something about beta. I said, well, beta could be anything. I want to be completely agnostic about it. So let's see what those types of beliefs would have, what kind of impact they might have on my inference. So if I use the uniform prior for the underreporting probability, right, and I run my simulation, I use the semi-parametric likelihood, this is what I got. So the pictures indicate the posterior density. And you see that the posterior density of P is pretty flat, which is exactly what you expect. Right? Remember that we're in a non-identified model, so the prior carries, you know, stays important throughout. And that's exactly what you see here. The posterior of beta, however, is fairly tight. And I've listed in the table below, I've actually given the 95% highest posterior density intervals. This is sort of the Bayesian equivalent of a confidence interval. And you see that the lower and upper limit is 4.9 to 15.6. That's incredibly tight relative to the non-parametric bounds. And so you see that here, inserting a little bit of information is very helpful in inference. Now, when you look at pi, this is the probability of abstinence. Remember, this is the mean of the binary variable that is misclassified. You're still pretty vague about that. You say, well, between 40% and 92% of the population could be abstinent. So that's, you know, you're not really learning much in that sense. However, the second prior is even more telling. So if you're willing to state that misclassification is a problem, but it's probably pretty small, right, then you use the prior F2. And if you do that, you see a posterior of P, right, which is centered close to zero, and a distribution for beta, which is even tighter relative to the previous table. Right, so here it's between, say, 5 and 8. Before, it was 4 and 15. Right, so you put a little more information in there, you get a lot, you know, even more sharper inference. And the same is true for pi. Right, now you can actually, this type of information helps you pin down the probability of abstinence in the population. Now it's between 84% and 92%. Right, that's still very wide, but and the same is true for beta, but that's just a consequence of the fact that these things are not identified. Right? And I have a semi-parametric model. Okay, I'm going to skip this one and just briefly conclude. So I would argue that Bayesian inference can be a very attractive option in these models, especially when you have these identification problems. Right? And misclassified data is one example of that. Missing data is another. This paper has just looked at the binary case, right? But it's easy to sit down and write a number of situations where these error problems are much more complicated. Right? So this is I see this as a first step in sort of a larger research agenda. in many cases, you can derive non-parametric bounds, but for practical applications, I'd say they're often not very helpful. So in that case, prior information in a Bayesian analysis can actually really help you a lot and sharpen inference. The one thing that you do need to keep in mind, and this goes to the missing data, the talk about missing data as well, is that in these models, the prior retains a lot of influence. And it's therefore very important to look at different priors, a range of different priors, assess the sensitivity, and make sure you understand what the implications are of these priors. Okay. I think that's it. I've listed here some references. If you're interested in having these slides, just send me an email and I can send them to you. And there's a bunch of references at the end.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I think that what you don't know can hurt you is what you're saying and what Ofer said in his talk in different ways. And it was interesting.